వక్రతుండ మహాకాయ సూర్యకోటి సమప్రభ నిర్విఘ్నం కురు మే దేవ సర్వకార్యషు సర్వదా శివశక్త్యాయుక్తో యది భవతి శక్తః ప్రభవితుం న చేదేవం దేవో న ఖలు కుశలః స్పందితుమపి అత స్వామారాధ్యా హరిహర విరించాదిభిరపి ప్రణంతుం స్తోతుం వా కతమకృత పుణ్యః ప్రభవతి.
Shri Sai Ram. At the outset, my most loving and prayerful salutations at the divine lotus feet of our most beloved Bhagwan, Shri Satya Sai Baba. Dear listener, you are tuned to Radio Sai Global Harmony on Asia Stream, bringing you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the love and the message of Bhagwan, Shri Satya Sai Baba. Good morning. Greetings and loving Sai Ram on this Thursday, on the 6th of August 2020, and you're with me, Team Radio Sai, Sunil, welcoming you to this morning segment, Divine Glory, on Thursday live from the studios of the Sri Satya Sai Media Center here at Prashanti Nilayam. For the benefit of those who have not read today's Sai Inspires message, let me first read out to you today's Sai Inspires message. How should we destroy fear and anxiety from our minds? Bhagwan lovingly reminds us today, quoting examples from our ancestors' lives, and I quote, "Today, people are fear-struck because they lack self-confidence. Life is meaningless without self-confidence. From self-confidence, you get courage. Our ancients led a sacred life, performing penance without any fear in the dense forests amidst wild animals and wicked demons. What was their source of courage and strength? They had no body attachment or dehabhimana. They attached themselves to the self, Atmabhimana. What was the weapon they carried with them? The weapon of self-confidence. With this, they could even tame wild animals like lions and tigers and play with them fearlessly. Today, people do not have faith in the self or Atma. They ask, where is Atma? Atma is everywhere. See the same Atma or Divine in all beings. Atmavat Sarva Bhutani. With hands, feet, eyes, heads, mouth and ears pervading every being, God permeates the entire universe." Unquote. This was taken from a divine discourse delivered by Bhagwan on May 16th. 2002. Dear listener, today in Divine Glory, I have lined up for you readings from the English version of the holy book Sri Sai Satcharitra, written by Sri Hemadpant, followed by the first part of a conversation with Dr. Ramanathan Iyer, a senior cardiologist serving at the Sri Sathya Sai Institute of Higher Medical Sciences, Prashanthi Gram. And this talk is about Ayurveda. In conversation with him is Professor G. Venkatraman, the former Vice Chancellor of the Sri Sathya Sai Institute of Higher Learning and also the former Director of Radio Sai. And this is from our archives and this was recorded in the year 2007. But first, readings from Sri Sai Satcharitra. Sri Sai Satcharitra is an account on the life and teachings of Sai Baba of Shirdi, written by Sri Hemad Pant. We are thankful to Vasanthi Sundaram for reading out the contents from this holy book and to Veeramani Kannan for the melodious musical support. Wishing you all a happy, holy and blessed Thursday and a wonderful day ahead. Also praying to Lord Almighty that the pandemic caused by the coronavirus disease be eradicated and all the suffering come to an end at the earliest. Samasta lokaha sukino bhavantu. Let me also play for you the Krimi mantra, which has the potency of destroying all harmful germs and viruses.
Om atrinatva krime hanmi kanvena jamadagnina vishvavaso brahmana hataha krimina gumraja apyesha vristapatir hataha atho mata atho pita atho sthura atho kshudra atho krishna atho shveta atho ashatika hata shveta bhissah sarve hata ahara vadya shrutasya havisho yata tat satyam yadamuyamasya jambhayo adadami tatahitat khanthan rasi om shanti shanti shanti.
Chapter 49, Stories of Hari Kanoba, Somdev Swami, Nana Saheb Chandorkar. Preliminary. When even the Vedas and the Puranas cannot sufficiently praise Brahma or the Sadguru, then how can we, the ignorant, describe our Sadguru, Sri Sai Baba? We think it is better for us to keep quiet in this matter. In reality, the observance of the vow of silence is the best way of praising the Sadguru. But the divine qualities of Sai Baba make us forget our vow of silence and inspire us to open our mouth. Tasteful dishes lose their taste if there is no company of friends and relatives to partake the dishes with us. But when they join us, the dishes acquire additional flavor. The same is the case with Sai Leelamrit, the nectar in the form of Sai's Leelas. This nectar we cannot partake alone. Friends and brothers have to join us. The more, the better. It is Sai Baba himself who inspires these stories and gets them written as he desires. Our duty is to surrender completely to Him and meditate on Him. Practicing penance is better than pilgrimage, vow, sacrifice and charity. Worshipping Hari is better than penance and meditation on the Sadguru is the best of all. We have therefore to chant Sai's name, think over His sayings in our mind, meditate on His form, feel true love for Him in our heart and do all our actions for His sake. There is no better means than this for snapping the bondage of this samsara. If we can do our duty on our part as stated above, Sai is bound to help and liberate us. Now, we revert to the stories of this chapter. Hari Kanoba. A gentleman of Mumbai named Hari Kanoba heard from his friends and relatives many leelas of Baba. He did not believe in them, as if he had a doubting mind. He wanted to see Baba himself. So he came to Shirdi with some Mumbai friends. He wore a lace-bordered turban on his head and a new pair of sandals on his feet. On seeing Baba from a distance, he thought of going to him and prostrating himself before him. He did not know what to do about his new sandals. After going to some corner in the open courtyard, he placed them there and went in the masjid and had Baba's darshan. He made a reverential bow to Baba took Udi and Prasad from Baba and returned. When he reached the corner, he found to his utter dismay that his sandals had disappeared. He searched for them in vain and returned to his lodging very much dejected. He bathed, offered worship and naivedya, and sat down for meals. But all this while he was thinking about nothing but his sandals. After finishing his meals, he came out to wash his hands, when he saw a Maratha boy coming towards him. He had in his hand a stick, at the end of which was hanging a pair of new sandals. He said to the men who had come out to wash their hands that Baba sent him with this stick in hand, and asked him to go on the streets crying, "Hari ka beta, Jari ka feta," and that if anybody claims these sandals, first assure yourself that his name is Hari, and that he is the son of Ka, that is Kanoba, and that he wears a lace-bordered turban, and then give them over to him. On hearing this, Hari Kanoba was pleasantly surprised. He went ahead to the boy and claimed the sandals as his own. He said to the boy that his name was Hari, and that he was the son of Ka, Kanoba, and showed him his lace-bordered turban. The boy was satisfied and returned the sandals to him. Hari Kanoba wondered in his mind that his lace-bordered turban was visible to all, and Baba might have seen it. But how could he know that his name was Hari, and that he was a son of Kanoba, as this was his first trip to Shirdi? He came there with the sole object of testing Baba, and with no other motive. He came to know by this incident that Baba was a great Satpurush. He got what he wanted, and returned home well pleased. Somdev Swami. Now hear the story of another man who came to try Baba. Bhaiji, brother of Kaka Sahib Dikshit, was staying at Nagpur. When he had gone to the Himalayas in 1906, he made an acquaintance with one Somdev Swami of Haridwar at Uttarkashi, down the Gangotri Valley. Both took down each other's names in their diaries. 5 years later, Swami came to Nagpur and was Bhaiji's guest. There he was pleased to hear the leelas of Baba, and a strong desire arose in his mind to go to Shirdi and see him. He got a letter of introduction from Bhaiji and left for Shirdi. After passing Manmad and Kopargaon, he took a tonga and drove to Shirdi. As he came near Shirdi, he saw two flags floating high over the masjid in Shirdi. Generally, we find different behavior, different mode of living, and different outward paraphernalia with different saints. But these outward signs should never be our standards to judge the worth of a saint. But with Somdev Swami, it was different. As soon as he saw the flags flying, he thought, why should a saint take a liking for the flags? Does this denote sainthood? It implies the saint's hankering after fame. Thinking thus, he wished to cancel his Shirdi trip, and said to his fellow travelers that he would go back. They said to him, then why did you come so far? If your mind became restless by the mere sight of the flags, how much more agitated would you be on seeing the rath, the palanquin, the horse, and other paraphernalia in Shirdi? The Swami got more confounded and said, not such sadhus with horses, palanquins, and tom-toms have I seen, and it is better for me to return than visit such sadhus. After saying this, he started to return. The fellow travelers pressed him not to do so, but to proceed. They asked him to stop his inconsistent way of thinking and told him that the sadhu, that is Baba, did not care a bit for the flags and other paraphernalia. It was the people, his devotees, that kept all this up out of love and devotion to him. Finally, he was persuaded to continue his journey, go to Shirdi and see Baba. When he went and saw Baba from the courtyard, he melted inside. His eyes were full of tears, his throat was choked, and all his evil and crooked thoughts vanished. He remembered his guru saying that is our abode and place of rest, where the mind is most pleased and settled. He wished to roll himself in the dust of Baba's feet, and when he approached Baba, the latter got wild and cried aloud, let all a humbug be with us. You go back to your home. Beware. If you come back to the masjid again, why take the darshan of one who flies a flag over his masjid? Is this a sign of sainthood? Remain here not a moment. The Swami was taken aback by surprise. He realized that Baba read his heart and spoke it out. How omniscient he was! He knew that he was least intelligent and that Baba was noble and pure. He saw Baba embracing somebody, touching someone with his hand, comforting others, staring kindly at some, laughing at others, giving Odi Prasad to some, and thus pleasing and satisfying all. Why should he alone be dealt so harshly? After thinking seriously, he came to realize that Baba's conduct responded exactly to his inner thought, and that he should take a lesson from this and improve, and that Baba's wrath was a blessing in disguise. It is needless to say that later on, his faith in Baba was confirmed and he became a staunch devotee of Baba. Nana Sahib Chandorkar. Hemad Pant concludes this chapter with a story of Nana Sahib Chandorkar. When Nana Sahib was once sitting in the masjid with Mahal Sapati and others, a Muslim gentleman from Bijapur came with his family to see Baba. On seeing veiled ladies with him, Nana Sahib wanted to go away, but Baba prevented him from doing so. The ladies came and took the darshan of Baba. When one of the ladies removed her veil in saluting Baba's feet, Nana Sahib, who had a glimpse of her face, was so much smitten with her beauty that he wished to see her face again. By knowing Nana's restlessness of mind, Baba spoke to him after the lady had left the place. "Nana, why are you getting agitated in vain? Let the senses do their allotted work or duty. We should not meddle with their work. God has created this beautiful world, and it is our duty to appreciate its beauty. The mind will get steady and calm slowly. When the front door was open, why go by the back one? When the heart is pure, there is no difficulty whatsoever. Why should one be afraid of anyone if there be no evil thought in us? Their eyes may do their work. Why should you feel shy and tottering?" Shama was there, and he could not follow the meaning of what Baba said. So he asked Nana about this on their way home. Nana told him about his restlessness at the sight of the beautiful lady, how Baba knew it and advised him about it. Nana explained Baba's meaning as follows: that her mind is fickle by nature. It should not be allowed to get wild. The senses may get restless. The body, however, should be held in check and not allowed to be impatient. Senses run after objects of desire, but we should not follow them and crave for them. By slow and gradual practice, restlessness can be conquered. We should not be swayed by the senses, though they cannot be completely controlled. We should curb them rightly and properly, according to the need of the occasion. Beauty is a subject of sight. We may fearlessly look at the beauty of objects. There is no room for shyness or fear. Only, we should never entertain evil thoughts. Making the mind desireless, observe God's work of beauty. In this way, the senses will be easily and naturally controlled, and even in enjoying objects, you will be reminded of God. If the outer senses are held in check, and if the mind be allowed to run after objects and be attached to them, our cycle of births and deaths will not come to an end. With Vivek, or discrimination, as a charioteer, we will control the mind and shall not allow the senses to go astray. With such a charioteer, we reach the Vishnupada, the final abode, our real home, from where there is no return. Bow to Sri Sai. Peace be to all. Chapter 50. Stories of Kaka Sahib Dixit, Sri Tembe Swami, Balaram Dhurandar. Chapter 50 of the original Sai Satcharitra has been incorporated in Chapter 39 as it dealt with the same subject matter. Now, Chapter 51 of the Satcharitra has been treated here as Chapter 50. This chapter gives the stories of Kaka Sahib Dixit, Sri Tembe Swami and Balaram Dhurandar. Preliminary. Victory be unto Sai, who is the mainstay of the bhaktas, who is a Sadguru, who expounds the meaning of the Gita and who gives us all power. O Sai, look favorably on us and bless us all. The sandalwood trees grow on the Malaya mountains and ward off heat. The clouds pour the rainwater and thereby cool and refresh all the people. The flowers blossom in the spring and enable us to worship God. So the stories of Sai Baba come forth in order to give solace and comfort to the readers. Both those who tell and those who hear the stories of Baba are blessed and holy. It is a well-established fact that though we try hundreds of means of sadhanas, we do not attain the spiritual goal of life unless a Sadguru blesses us with his grace. Hear the following story in illustration of this statement. Kakai Sahib Dixit, 1864-1926. Mr. Hari Sita Ram, alias Kakai Sahib Dixit, was born in 1864 in Badnagaranagar in a Brahmin family at Khandwa. His primary education was done at Khandwa, Hingan Ghat, and secondary education at Nagpur. He came to Mumbai for higher education and studied first in Wilson College and then in Elphinstone College. After graduation in 1883, he passed his LLB and solicitor's examinations and then served in the firm of the government solicitors Messrs. Little and Co. and then, after some time, started a solicitor's firm on his own. Before 1909, Sai Baba's name was not familiar to Kaka Sahib, but after that he soon became his great devotee. While he was staying at Lonavala, he happened to see his old friend Mr. Nana Sahib Chandorkar. Both spent some time in talking about many things. Kaka Sahib described to him how while he was boarding a train in London, he met with an accident in which his foot slipped and was injured. Hundreds of remedies gave him no relief. Nana Sahib then told him that if he wished to get rid of the pain and lameness of his leg, he should go to his Sadguru Sai Baba. He also gave him all the particulars of Sai Baba and mentioned to him Sai Baba's dictum, "I draw to me my man from far off or even across the seven seas like a sparrow with a string fastened to its feet." He also made it clear to him that if he was not Baba's man, he would not be attracted to him and given darshan. Kaka Sahib was pleased to hear all this and said to Nana Sahib that he would go to Baba, see him and pray to him to cure not so much his lame leg, but bring around his lame, fickle mind and give him eternal bliss. Sometime later, Kaka Sahib went to Ahmednagar and stayed with Sardar Kaka Sahib Mirikar in connection with securing votes for a seat in the Mumbai Legislative Council. Mr. Bala Sahib Mirikar, son of Kaka Sahib Mirikar, who was a Mamlatdar of Kopargaon, also came at that time to Ahmednagar in connection with a horse exhibition there. After the election business was over, Kaka Sahib Dixit wanted to go to Shirdi, and both the Mirikar's father and son were also thinking about a fit and proper person as a guide with whom he should be sent there. There, Sai Baba was arranging things for his reception. Shama got a telegram from his father-in-law at Ahmednagar stating that his wife was seriously ill and that he should come to see her with his wife. Shama, with Baba's permission, went there and saw his mother-in-law and found her improving and better. Nana Sahib Panse and Appa Sahib Gadre happened to see Shama on their way to the exhibition and they told him to go to Mirikar's house, see Kaka Sahib Dixit there and take him to Shirdi along with him. Kaka Sahib Dixit and the Mirikars were also informed of Shama's arrival. In the evening, Shama came to the Mirikars, who introduced him to Kaka Sahib. They arranged that Shama should leave for Kopargaon with Kaka Sahib by the 10 o'clock night train. After this was settled, a curious thing happened. Bala Sahib Mirikar threw aside the veil or covering on Baba's big portrait and showed the same to Kaka Sahib. He was surprised to see that he, whom he was going to meet at Shirdi, was already there in the form of his portrait to greet him at this juncture. He was much moved and made his prostration before the portrait. This portrait belonged to Megha. The glass over it was broken and it was sent to Mirikar's for repairs. The necessary repairs had been already made and it was decided to return the portrait with Kaka Sahib and Shama. Before 10 o'clock, they went to the station and booked their passage. But when the train arrived, they found that the second class was overcrowded and there was no room for them. Fortunately, the guard of the train turned out to be an acquaintance of Kaka Sahib and he put them up in the first class. Thus, they travelled comfortably and alighted at Kopargaon. Their joy knew no bounds when they saw there Nana Sahib Chandorkar, who was also bound for Shirdi. Kaka Sahib and Nana Sahib embraced each other and then, after bathing in the sacred Godavari River, they started for Shirdi. After coming there and getting Baba's darshan, Kaka Sahib's mind was melted, his eyes were full of tears and he was overflowing with joy. Baba said to him that he was also waiting for him and had sent Shama ahead to receive him. Kaka Sahib then passed many happy years in Baba's company. He built a wada in Shirdi, which he made as his, more or less, the permanent home. The experiences he got from Baba are so many that it is not possible to relate them all here. The readers are advised to read a special Kaka Sahib Dikshit number of Sri Sai Leela magazine, volume 12, number 6 to 9. We close this account with a mention of one fact only. Baba had comforted him saying that in the end he would take him in a coach or viman, that is, secure him a happy death. This came out true. On 5th July 1926, Kaka Sahib was travelling in the train with Hemant Pant and talking about Sai Baba. He seemed deeply engrossed in Sai Baba. All of a sudden, he threw his neck on Hemant Pant's shoulder and breathed his last with no trace of pain and uneasiness. Sri Tembe Swami. We come to the next story, which shows how saints love each other with fraternal affection. Once, Sri Vasudevanand Saraswati, known as Sri Tembe Swami, encamped at Rajahmundry in Andhra, on the banks of the Godavari. He was devout, orthodox, dhyani and yogi bhakt of Dattatreya. One Mr. Pundalik Rao, pleader of Nanded, went to see him with some friends. While they were talking with him, the names of Shirdi and Sai Baba were casually mentioned. Hearing Baba's name, the Swami joined hands with reverence and taking a coconut, gave it to Pundalik Rao and said to him, "Offer this to my brother Sai with my pranam and request him not to forget me but to ever love me." He also added that Swamis do not generally bow to others, but in this case an exception had to be made. Mr. Pundalik Rao consented to take the coconut and his message to Baba. The Swami was right in calling Baba a brother, for as he maintained an Agnihotra day and night in his orthodox fashion, Baba too kept his Agnihotra dhuni ever burning in the masjid. After 1 month, Pundalik Rao and others left for Shirdi with the coconut and reached Manmad, and as they felt thirsty, they went to a rivulet for drinking water. As water should not be drunk on an empty stomach, they took out some refreshment, that is chivda, flattened rice mixed with spice. The chivda tasted most pungent, and in order to soften it, as someone suggested, broke the coconut and mixed its scrapings with it. Thus, they made the chivda more tasty and palatable. Unfortunately, the coconut turned out to be the same that was entrusted to Pundalik Rao. As they neared Shirdi, Pundalik Rao remembered the trust, that is the coconut, and was very sorry to learn that it was broken and consumed. He came to Shirdi and saw Baba. Baba had already received a wireless message regarding the coconut from the Tembe Swami, and himself asked Pundalik Rao first to give the thing sent by his brother. Pundalik Rao held fast Baba's feet, confessed his guilt and negligence, repented and asked for Baba's pardon. He offered to give another fruit as a substitute, but Baba refused to accept it, saying that the worth of the coconut was far more than an ordinary one and that it could not be replaced by another. Baba also added, "Now you need not worry yourself any more about the matter. It was on account of my wish that the coconut was entrusted to you and ultimately broken on the way. Why should you take the responsibility of the actions on you? Do not entertain the sense of doership in doing good as well as for bad deeds. Be entirely prideless and egoless in all things, and then your spiritual progress will be rapid." What a beautiful spiritual instruction Baba gave. Balaram Dhurandhar, 1878-1925. Mr. Balaram Dhurandhar belonged to the Pathare Prabhu community of Santa Cruz, Mumbai. He was an advocate of the Mumbai High Court and sometime principal of the Government Law School, Mumbai. The whole Dhurandhar family was pious and religious. Mr. Balaram served his community and wrote and published an account of it. He then turned his attention to spiritual and religious matters. He studied carefully Gita and its commentary, Dhyaneshwari, and other philosophical and metaphysical works. He was a devotee of Vithoba of Pandharpur. He came in contact with Sai Baba in 1912. 6 months earlier, his brothers Babuji and Vaman Rao came to Shirdi and took Baba's darshan. They returned home and mentioned their sweet experiences to Balaram and other members. Then they all decided to see Sai Baba. Before they came to Shirdi, Baba said openly, "Today many of my Darbar people are coming." The Dhurandhar brothers were astonished to hear this remark of Baba from the others, as they had not given any previous intimation of their trip. All other people prostrated themselves before Baba and sat talking with him. Baba said to them, "These are my Darbar people whom I referred to before," and said to the Dhurandhar brothers, "We are acquainted with each other for the last 60 generations." All the brothers were gentle and modest. They stood with joined hands, looking at Baba's feet. All the sattvic emotions, such as tears, horripilation, choking, etc., moved them, and they were all very happy. Then they went to the lodging, took their meals, and after taking a little rest, again came back to the masjid. Balaram sat near Baba, massaging his legs. Baba, who was smoking the chillum, advanced it towards him and beckoned him to smoke it. Balaram was not accustomed to smoking, still he accepted the pipe, smoked it with great difficulty and returned it reverentially. This was a most auspicious moment for Balaram. He was suffering from asthma for 6 years. The smoke completely cured him of the disease, which never troubled him again. Some 6 years later, on a particular day, he again got an attack of asthma. This was precisely the time when Baba took his Mahasamadhi. The day of this visit was a Thursday, and the Dhurandhar brothers had the good fortune of witnessing the Chavadi procession that night. At the Aarti function in the Chavadi, Balaram saw the glow of Pandurangan Baba's face, and the next morning at the Kakar Aarti time, the same phenomenon, the same luster of the beloved deity Pandurang was visible again on Baba's face. Mr. Balaram Dhurandhar wrote in Marathi the life of the Maharashtra Saint Tukaram, but he did not survive to see its publication. It was published later on by his brothers in 1928. In a short note on Balaram's life given in the beginning of the book, the above account of Balaram's visit has been fully corroborated. Bow to Sri Sai. Peace be to all. Epilogue. We have done with chapter 51, and now we come to the last chapter, number 52 in the original. In this, Hemant Pant gives his concluding remarks and promised to give an index giving the contents of all the chapters in verse as is given in Marathi sacred books. But unfortunately, that index was not found in Hemad Pant's papers. It was therefore composed and supplied by an able and worthy devotee of Sai Baba, Mr. B. V. Dev. As the given English books, an index in the beginning and contents of each chapter at its top, we need not consider the last chapter as index here, and so we consider this chapter as the epilogue. Unfortunately, Hemad Pant did not survive to revise the manuscript of this chapter and make it ready for the press. When it was sent to the press, Mr. Dev found it to be incomplete and unintelligible in certain places, but it had to be published as it was. The main topics dealt with are given below briefly. Greatness of Sadguru Sai. We prostrate ourselves before and take refuge in that Sai Samarth, who besets all animate and inanimate things in the universe, who pervades all creatures equally without any differentiation, to whom all devotees are alike, and who knows not honor and dishonor, like or dislike. If we remember him and surrender to him, he fulfills all our wishes and makes us attain the goal of life. This ocean of mundane existence is very hard to cross. Waves of attachments beat high against the bank of bad thoughts and break down trees of fortitude. The breeze of egoism blows with force and makes the ocean rough and agitated. Crocodiles in the form of anger and hatred move there fearlessly. Eddies in the form of the idea, I and mine, and other doubts whirl there incessantly, and innumerable fishes in the form of censure, hate and jealousy play there. Though this ocean is so fierce and terrible, Sadguru Sai is its Agasthi, destroyer, and the devotees of Sai have the least fear of it. Our Sadguru is the boat which will safely take us across this ocean. Prayer. Now we fall before Sai Baba and, holding his feet, make the following prayer for the public. Let not our mind wander and desire anything except Thee. Let this work, Sai Satcharitra, be in every house and let it be studied daily. Let it ward off the calamities of those who study it regularly with reverence. Phalashruti, reward of study. Now a few words about the reward you get from this work. After bathing in the sacred Godavari and after taking the darshan of the Samadhi in the Samadhi Mandir at Shirdi, you should read or hear the Sai Satcharitra. If you do this, all your threefold afflictions will vanish. Casually thinking about the stories of Sai, you will get interested in spiritual life. And if you go through it with love and reverence, all your sins will be destroyed. If you wish to get rid of the cycle of births and deaths, read Sai's stories and remember him always and get yourself devoted to his feet. If you dive into the sea of Sai's stories and then give them out to others, you will get an ever new flavor of them and save the hearers from future misery. If you go on meditating on Sai's form, it will, in course of time, lead you into self-realization. It is very hard to know or realize the nature of self or Brahma, but if you approach through the Sagun Brahma, Sai's form, your progress will be easy. If the devotee completely surrenders himself to him, he will lose his individual ego and be merged in him and be one with him, as a river becomes one with the sea. If you thus become merged with him in any of the three states, that is waking, dream and sleep, you get rid of the bond of samsara. If anybody, after bathing, reads this with love and faith and completes it within a week, his calamities will disappear. Or if he hears or reads daily and regularly, all his dangers will be warded off. He will get the reward according to his faith and devotion. Without these, there will be no experience of any kind. If you read this with reverence, Sai will be pleased, and by removing your ignorance and poverty, will give you knowledge, wealth, and prosperity. With concentrated mind, if you read a chapter daily, it will give you unbounded happiness. One who has his own welfare at heart should study it carefully, and then he will ever remember Sai gratefully and joyfully in birth after birth. This work should be read at home, especially on Guru Purnima, Gokulashtami, Ram Navami, and Dasara, Baba's Punyatithi. If you study this one book carefully, all your desires will be satisfied. And if you always remember Sai's feet in your heart, you will easily cross the Bhavasagar. By its study, the diseased and sick will get health, the poor, wealth, the mean and afflicted, the prosperity, and the mind will get rid of all futile ideas and get steadiness. Dear devoted readers and listeners, we also bow to you all and make a special request. Never forget him whose stories you have read day by day or month by month. The more fervently you read or listen to these stories, the more encouragement Sai gives us to serve you and be of use to you. Both the author and the readers must cooperate in this work, help each other and be happy. Prasad Yachana. We close this with a prayer to the Almighty for the following prasad of favor. May the readers and devotees get complete and wholehearted devotion to Sai's feet. May his form be ever fixed in their eyes, and may they see Sai the Lord in all beings. Bow to Sri Sai. Peace be to all.
Sai Baba, Sai Baba, Shri Guru Sai Baba.
Sai Baba, Sai Baba, Satguru Shiradi Baba.
मंगल गिरिधर साई बाबा
मंगल गिरिधर साई बाबा
श्री गुरु पूर्णा साई बाबा
श्री गुरु पूर्णा साई बाबा
करुणा सागर साई बाबा
करुणा सागर साई बाबा
नित्य निरंजन साई बाबा Sai Baba, Sai Baba, Shri Guru Sai Baba.
Sai Baba, Sai Baba, Satguru Shiradi Baba.
Ah Sai Ram listeners, we have the pleasure of having with us Dr. Iyer, Dr. Ramanathan Iyer to give his full name. He has been with us before and many of you might have heard our conversation with him on his experiences as a doctor, especially serving in Swami's hospital. Today he is here on a rather different mission and I would say a unique mission. I have tried to persuade Dr. Iyer to do a series for us and let's hope I'd be successful, but certainly I've been able to catch him and here he is for the first conversation, shall I say. And we wish to discuss the body-mind relationship, especially in relation to health. Now, as you probably are aware, in the Western tradition, a disease is something associated with a particular organ. It may be liver or stomach or heart or lung or whatever it is, and it is treated that way. But somehow, all these people who do this seem to forget that what goes on in the body is not chemistry but biochemistry. Biochemistry is terribly different from chemistry, as any chemistry professor would tell you. And our tradition has it that it is the mind that plays a very large role in deciding how the body functions. And if you have a healthy and stable mind, the body would have to be stable substantially. That is our ancient thesis and belief. And somehow lately we seem to have forgotten all the ancient wisdom. And Dr. Iyer is a great believer in ancient wisdom and he's very passionate about it. So I brought him here so that he can communicate some of his wisdom and passion and also tell us a few things we should do and a few things we should not do about our body and how we should deal with our mind in controlling our body and disciplining our body. Dr. Iyer, I think I have given you a fairly long introduction. So let me turn the mic over to you so that you can make, shall I say, your opening statement.
Thank you very much, sir. At the outset, offering my most reverential pranam at the lotus feet of my beloved master, Bhagwan. Sai Ram to all the listeners of Radio Sai Global Harmony. A very thought-provoking subject, I would say a bit controversial subject also, has been introduced by Professor...
Why is it controversial?
I'll say why. In today's world, I'm talking, mind you, in the context of today's world, major portions of the people, if you see, if you try to talk to anybody for that matter, even the most educated person to a most illiterate man, when you try to impress upon them that the body-mind complex, you cannot separate them, you cannot segregate them. They work in harmony, it is the influence of one on the other. They'll think that either you have escaped from a mental asylum and come, or they'll feel that if you are not gone to one, you need to go. But I would wish to draw my attention intuitively, if all of us look back, at some point in time during the stage of our physical growth, maybe during adolescence or teens, we do have realized that we had that element of the mental control over the body. Unfortunately, the environment, the circumstances, they trained us in such a way that slowly, slowly, as we grew up, we forgot conveniently the influence of mind on body.
You say we once had control of mind over body. Can you explain that? Because that is not very clear to me.
Yeah.
When was this? When did it happen? And how did we lose this control?
See, the Vedas or our ancient scriptures, they have been harping on it from times immemorial. Unfortunately, the way the modern science took up, it thought that by dissecting each part or each organ, it will come to a revelation. I am myself a practitioner of modern science, so I am not being, anti to it. But what I say, they could succeed to a large extent in almost all organ systems, except the brain. Till today, I request anybody in the world to give me one good comprehensive definition of what is mind. Number one. Number two, genesis of thought. You may write reams and reams and reams and reams of paper, but can you just reduce thought to be just a series of electrobiochemical event? If it were so, then you can actually modulate thought. One aspect of it. Two, the same modern science, maybe up to the 40s and 1950s, scoffed and laughed at clairvoyance, clairport, telekinesis, telepathy, hypnosis. Today, why that same science has come out and out in support of it? It's another thing that
you talked of hypnosis. I know psychiatrists apparently use it, but do clinical doctors and others believe in hypnosis, accept it in the Western world, that is?
Yes, a group of them who are with an open mind, who are not constipated in their outlook, they agree to it. I have a very small question. It has occurred, I think, to all of us at some point in time in our lives. You are sitting busy with some of your work. Suddenly a very, very weird stray thought about somebody or someone whom you have attachment to or you love comes to your mind. Say, for small example, I am staying here at Puttaparthi. Just 2 days before, say, I had talked to my father and everything is fine and all. This happened in June. And suddenly I find that around 29th or 30th or 31st I have talked. First morning itself, I am uncomfortable. Now you may ask me, what is this uncomfortable? I can't express. There is a kind of agitation in the mind. I don't know what it is. In the hearts of heart, something, hope everything is fine. Then I rationalize, always the brain rationalizes. Day before only I have talked with him. Everything is fine. The evening I get a thing that he is seriously ill.
Your father?
Yeah. This I get it by a phone call.
And you had some advanced feelings about it.
You may call it premonition. I am talking a very recent even. Like this, I am not telling it's only for so-called dangerous or bad events. Even for many good events. Even sometimes upon arrival of a person. When the person hasn't even informed you, in the wildest of your dreams, you wouldn't know that person will come. And you have a feeling that person is going to come.
Okay, so your point is, the mind has capabilities beyond biology.
Yes.
Am I right? Is that what you're saying?
Because the modern biological science has failed to understand this potentiality.
Yeah, that is true, because there is one thing which everybody talks about, and it's a word accepted in the English language, it's there in the dictionary, consciousness.
Yes.
What is consciousness? Nobody is able to define. Right. Like time, you can experience it, but you cannot define it. So, consciousness, of course, we associate with the brain, others associate it with the mind. It is there, jolly well there, but we don't know what it is. And many scientists say, let us not talk about something we don't know. Let's leave it alone. But there are others who sort of defy it and deny it and say it's all connected with the meat machine. I suppose what you're saying is ancient wisdom says there is something beyond gross matter.
Exactly. Exactly.
And mind is that which is beyond the gross brain.
Definitely. Definitely. Because that is why, see, to put a compartmentalized, like we have in medical science, WHO certified definition for various diseases. If I state it in any forum, nobody will challenge me. You don't have such a definition for mind. So much so, a few years back, in the definition of health by WHO, they included a spiritual well-being also.
WHO did?
Yes.
Oh, how did they change their
See, finally,
attitude?
Finally, the acceptance is coming. See,
what made them accept it?
See, globally, if you see, it's not that we think that only in India we have this kind of scriptural things. We have our legacy, and from childhood we get from our parents and all. But let me tell you, even West, particularly in the US, where I have some amounts of contacts, there is a group of very active, brilliant, modern-day trained scientists, medical scientists, who are doing some excellent piece of research. One I would kindly bring to your attention, Professor Michel Krokoff.
Oh yes, he had come here.
Yes, you must have heard of him.
Oh, Duke University.
Duke University. And you must have heard his talks, you must have read. Mind you, he works in the Duke University as an interventional cardiologist. He is one of the approved investigators in the United States of America. And this great professor goes on to, of course, he got influenced by Bhagwan, and he came to Bhagwan and he put forth this idea. And very heartily and happily Bhagavan said, this is the direction in which your work should go. And he devises a pilot project. And it was very simple. Very, very simple.
It's such a noetic project. And we have discussed it in our Radio Sai
program.
But now I want to go back to the Vedas. You said the Vedic seers understood the profound connection between the mind and the body and the interrelationship, etc., etc. Am I right in assuming that some of this knowledge was formally encoded into what we call Ayurveda?
Ayurveda, after all, was a practical extension of it. I am talking if it is practiced in the true...
I am talking what people talk of Ayurveda,
definitely.
Something that goes back. And one thing, you can correct me if I am wrong, but one thing which I have heard people say, who know a thing or two about Ayurveda, they said, listen, you think Ayurveda is a system of medicine, treatment. No, Ayurveda is a system of well-being. And if it so happens that your body is not well, Ayurveda prescribes some treatment for it. Basically, it is well-being in which illness is treated as a subset. Is it right?
See, a beautiful word in English, dis-ease. Dis-ease.
Oh, we never think of it that way.
See, it suddenly occurred to me one day, some many years back. This is mental disease, physical disease, all diseases. Disease. Who ever coined that word? I don't know that. But such an apt.
You're not at ease.
You're not at ease. Whether it's a pain due to heart attack, whether it is a abdominal cramp due to gastroenteritis, or it is a paralysis due to a cerebral stroke, you're definitely not at ease. Such a beautiful thing. And Ayurveda, if you see the basic philosophy, that is why it calls...
Why don't you give us a little introduction on Ayurveda? Because many people may not know what it's all about.
The name itself, Ayurveda. Ayur, as you know in Sanskrit, is life or longevity.
The Veda of longevity.
Longevity. They never talked of Aushadhi Shastra or Bhaishaja Vigyan and all those things. They never talked. They gave
Which means medicine and...
Medicine.
Like
Bhaishaja means medicine. As you rightly pointed out, one arm of that, in fact, if you see, if you ask me, that was, I think, only one system of medicine which had a very holistic approach. It started, in fact, right from the way the patient walked into the Vaidya, or the so-called doctor of Ayurveda was called a Vaidya. When the way the person walked in, from that moment onwards, the diagnostic process starts. The way he comes and sits and presents his complaints, that is analyzed. And it doesn't end with the modern kind of question. Oh, what is your problem? Sir, I have a stomachache. What else, sir? I passed 2 loose stools. Okay, fine. Lie down, pulse, blood pressure, check the temperature, antibiotics for 3 days. It didn't end with that. This man will sit through, he'll go, okay, what kind of profession? What is the kind of domestic atmosphere you're having? Has there been any recent disturbance? Like that, he'll come around, and then only his actual examination of the physical examination starts. Wherein, at some point in time in the history of Ayurveda, they had an excellent mastery over interpreting the peripheral pulse.
What do you mean by peripheral pulse?
The radial pulse. What we modern people use it only for maybe calculating the heart rate and sometimes
That is what you feel near the wrist.
Near the wrist. The wrist pulse. Modern medicine is only left with, okay, I can tell you now with my maybe about nearly 2 decades of experience, I can tell you your blood pressure will be this much. Beyond that, I didn't know. They had a full-fledged advanced science exclusively based on pulse analysis.
So, if I understand you correctly, their only diagnostic tool was the pulse.
Mainly, yes.
Mainly, more or less. And from that, they could infer quite a lot.
Quite a lot in the sense that they had, which again is coming back, sort of disturbance of the so-called 3 humors in the body, what they call, the vata, pitta and kapha, what they call, the gaseous element, the mucoid element, and the bilious element, to put it. So they found that, if you see now in today's biochemical thing, the whole body, if you see as a whole, one of these elements predominates in one of the systems. And they thought that most of the diseases arose from an imbalance from one of these humors.
Okay, getting back to this pulse, Normally, you doctors examine the pulse for about a minute or two at the most, and then you switch on to your stethoscope and stuff like that. The Ayurvedic Vaidya, how long did he feel the pulse of the patient? That's the reason why I'm asking this question.
Sometimes 15 to 20 minutes, during which time nobody is supposed to interrupt or disturb the person. So what I say is, he didn't have any modern diagnostic
tools.
Obviously
not.
Nothing. The fingertips are supposed to be very sensitive as far as to touch and pressure. He had only that. With that, just feeling the pulse, he could actually differentiate so many finer nuances based on what is the disturbance.
Before I go on to citing a parallel, I want to ask you a question. Do you think we have lost the sensitivity of the fingertips?
Not
or
only
it's still there with us, latent, not, unknown to us?
Not only fingertips. Mm. In fact, today the modern man has basically become a vegetable, if you ask me. We had so many. See, there are two kinds of things. One is instinctive behavior, which was very well demonstrated way back, I think, in the late 60s or 70s, when the Russians they took a warm with a tank with warm water at around 37 degrees, and a lady in labor was put inside that, and she was nicely enjoying. And inside that, with her labor, she had a normal delivery, and I was lucky enough to see a beautiful short film of that whole episode, and they show how very effortlessly, with minimal pain, the baby was delivered out, and then this baby swims up all the way, comes to the surface, takes its first breath. What modern medicine today says as is, okay, that is the sign of life and this thing. Takes the breath, again dives in. And it was such a beautiful thing. This goes on to prove that instinctively, swimming as a trait is present in all of us.
No, what I'm saying is, in terms of doctors, today, you say it is still, these skills are latent in us, the diagnosis through sense of touch, but we don't use it, and therefore it has become blunted.
Not only touch, sir. Touch is one aspect of it. See, today there has been, I would call it...
What are the other techniques that the Ayurveda Vaidya used? That's what I'm trying to say.
Vision,
write.
I told you.
Oh.
The moment a person walks in, your diagnosis starts.
And then hearing,
the way he is talking, the skin, even the skin tone and color that mattered, how the eyes looked. Just by sitting and watching, he is seeing what is the pattern of his respiration. See, just a person coming and sitting, hardly within 30 seconds...
Intense observation. It's very interesting. I am tempted to rob a little bit of your time to narrate a story told to me by a doctor in Bangalore. He was my father's family doctor in the last stages. He told me he was going to London on some work. He had borrowed a book from a friend of his. That happened to be an Anglo-Indian family, whereas he was a Mangalorean Brahmin. And the lady there, this was some interesting book, had given the book to him, to Dr. Pai, his name is. And he went to her house to return, say, I'm going to London and all that. It seems she was a very nice lady, sweet lady, but that day, when he knocked on the door, she yelled at him. He was taken aback. He didn't say anything. She snatched the book and went inside. He said it was bugging him. He went to London. As soon as he went to the hotel, he called the residence in Bangalore. He knew the number. The lady picked up. He said, please hand over the phone to your husband. He said, you please take your wife immediately to Sutton Hospital and have her brain tested. And don't tell her anything. He just said, just come along. And when they did it, it seemed there was a tumor. So I asked him, how on earth did you... You didn't go there as a doctor. You went there as, you know, to do a courtesy. And when you were telling me this thing about vision and, you know, that extrasensory perception, I was reminded of that particular incident. Now going back to this nadi or pulse, I was reminded of what I read by a man called Bill Moyes. He used to be a presidential assistant, I think, in the time of Johnson or somebody. He's a very smart man now. He does a lot of radio shows and all that. He went to China. He didn't come to India. And he says when he went to the medical college, he found the Chinese doctors were taking pulse for 20 minutes. He said, you're mad, you're wasting your time. In America, they don't do it for more than 40 seconds. And then the Chinese doctor apparently surprised him by telling what all he is able to find in 20 minutes. This man couldn't believe it. And later on, he took a lot of doctors and they found that it was true. So what I'm trying to say is it appears that in China also there was holistic medicine of some kind or the other.
I think.
How right am I?
Yeah, China, in fact, even more advanced than China is the Tibetan system of medicine.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there is one there.
Tibetan system of medicine, I don't know for whatever reasons why they wanted to keep it cloistered behind closed doors, I don't know.
Secret.
See, very secretive. And in fact, the qualification for entering into the so-called Tibetan system of medicine, I had read it long back, was once the pupil goes to the that guru or the master, what is this thing? Master apparently will allot him some small cave-like thing. Mm. Then go and sit there and start meditating.
Mm.
And this master is obviously a very evolved man. And remotely he is able to find out how effective is his meditation. And that was the first test he has to clear before he can qualify to enter into the system of medicine. See, herein I would, when you put this question, that's what I said. The modern system of science as it has evolved today has had its wonderful advantages. I am not at all denying it. But what I said was,
it is too analytic, it's not holistic.
Number one. Number two, what people fail to realize that it is the same brain given by the God which brought forth all these things.
That's true.
Today we say nanotechnology is the thing of the future and you say supercomputer and all those things. Who created a supercomputer? It is that fantastic brain given by the God. The only difference between what you say today as modern science and what the ancients had, if you see our own this one, today you have, okay, you'll say astronomy as a science, you have got big radio telescopes and you view and you say movement and all. Those days, the whole branch of astrology, they, if you see, I am not going for the predictive aspect of it. How could they so precisely measure movements when they didn't even have a watch or a clock? The movement of the sun was their only source. That what it means is they could associate themselves very closely with nature, number one. Number two, all the faculties which the indriyas, what you call, the senses, they knew how to put it to effective use. And this is what the ancient man did. Today, slowly with our progress, we have got diverse from all those things. We have become so much artificial that we are ourselves not aware of this treasure which we are carrying.
Okay, now that prompts a question. When I have a problem, I go to a doctor and end up having, many people believe it's excessive medication. Supposing I want to avoid it. Of course, a certain amount of medication may be unavoidable. Is there anything I can do using the power of the mind to partially assist the healing process?
Well, let me make this point very clear that most of my professional brethren, they are under the impression that it is that a bunch of pills which they write which is doing the magic. From my own whatever intuitive observation and inferences which I have drawn.
By the way, it looks like Dr. Deepak Chopra doesn't subscribe to that because he says pill popping is a modern disease.
No, fine. What
But he says something about...
What I say is, whether you pop a pill in the modern or you take the rasabhasmas of Ayurveda, or asavas or arishtas, they are medicines in Ayurveda. Or you take those sugar-coated pills of homeopathy. Or whatever other systems of medicine you have. Any system of medicine just facilitates the body to recover. Whatever you are using. It is not that, okay, somebody gets an infection. By giving an appropriate antibiotic, you claim that, oh, I gave him the best, the correct, apt antibiotic I gave, that's why in 5 days he recovered. What you fail to understand is, the antibiotic only was an aid to the person's own immune system to get over it. Any system of medicine, number one. Number two, you may be actually, your era, at least you must have seen, those were the days of what you call family doctors.
Yes, sir. GPB, yeah.
Family doctors. And he was almost, I think, next only to God.
Yes, yes, very much so.
I have seen at least my own granddad, who was one of those generation doctors he was. And what was it, why, for any complaint, irrespective of the system involved in the family, any health-related problem, the first person to be approached was that family physician.
I remember very well.
And why was there that so much of an immense faith in that man? Those were the times when you didn't have packaged medicine. Most of the medicines were dispensed medicine, which used mix some mixtures and some powders.
There was a man called Compounder.
Compounder was there.
Swami uses that word, but I don't think the modern boys understand what it means.
And the compounder, he'll say, formula number 456, some 3 and 4 are mixtures are mixed, give it. You used to get okay. What I said, that element, what today modern medicine says, the patient-physician relationship and all those things, that kind of a relationship, it was more thicker than a family bond, ceases to exist today.
I might understand that more important than the antibiotics, etc., which anyway merely assist the system already built into the body by God, the human element is important.
I would say human element is the only element.
Okay, you hit the nail very strongly on that.
And if you permit me, I'll just quote a very small event which occurred one day in the veranda. Bhagwan, on one Sunday noon, he came out and those days, I am talking, this was around 95-96, he used to enjoy ragging the doctors.
Yes, so I remember those days.
He'll collect 6-7 of them around him in the veranda and he'll start off. I was a witness to one, and I was actually sitting just maybe a couple of inches away from his lotus feet, and periodically he was giving me a glance, and his talk started off on diet.
Diet, okay.
Diet started off. And he made you doctors tell protein and carbohydrate and vitamin and mineral and that and this and all. And he said, see this body. Bhagavan was showing his own. This body now eats only one ragi roti, that's a tortilla or whatever you call, and one glass of plain water. No milk, no tea, no Bonvita, no Horlicks. And I am able to do much more physical work than what you people less than half my age are doing. That's how the thing started. It so happened that some patient had approached some doctor somewhere, and apparently the patient was suffering from some form of a terminal illness. And the concerned doctor apparently told the in a very matter-of-fact way to the patient and to the relative. They in turn came crying to Bhagwan, and then that's how Bhagwan came there. He made one statement which even to today it rings in my ears. Every time I see somebody with a terminal illness whom I deal, he said, patient comes to you. You are all highly educated doctors, next only to God. You know that, okay, this man with his present condition is not going to live for another 2 hours. In spite of having that knowledge, to the patient you tell, I have examined you, don't worry, I am giving you some medicine, everything will be fine. Don't be surprised that he lives for another 2 months. The same thing you tell him, okay, very grave, very serious, your expression on your face changes, oh, this is a hopeless case. Nothing can, and you should see Bhagwan's emotive face. No, the way he's one of the best actors in the world, I would say.
Yes.
He says, the way he said, oh, very, the condition is very bad. I don't know what's going to happen. If it goes like this, not more than 2 hours. He says, in next 15 to 20 minutes, the patient would have already departed.
You know, when Swami went to Bombay in 1999, March, I had the blessing to be with him. There was some big meeting in Cooperage. It was a football ground in South Bombay. The elite of Bombay came. It was something like a public reception, and all the sheriff and people like that spoke. There was a man who headed the Rotary Club. He is actually a medical doctor. His name is Dr. Vyas. He came in a black suit, bow tie and all that sort of thing. And he spoke there. His was a very positive speech. All the others were very negative. They were crying about the state of Bombay and all that. He said something which I am reminded of based on your remark. He said once there was an accident in the Suburban Railway, and a lot of emergency cases had to be attended to, and two were brought to his hospital, some neighboring hospital, I don't remember which one it was. both were sitting next to each other in the compartment, and both had very similar injuries, rather serious injuries, and both were of the same build, same age, etc., etc., and both needed the same kind of medical attention. He said, one man kept on saying, I'm going to die, I'm going to die, and he died. The other man said, I'm not going to die, I'm going to live, and he lived. And he said, that man had faith in God, and that's why he lived, and he went to Swami and simply did namaskar, that God is here. So this faith seems to be a very, 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 very important matter.
Same, again you come back to the influence of mind over body.
Exactly.
See, this God and all, what is just an external projection of what is already existing within us. If you really go to the root of it, I would say a very upsetting incident on what you currently mentioned. A very close family friend of ours, mm-hmm. 48 years of age. I was working in the steel plant intensive care unit. Very healthy
in
man.
Bilai. In Madhya Pradesh.
And
that was before you came here.
Before I joined here, I was in the intensive care. This, of course, he was an engineer in the plant, 48 years of age. He comes one day, I am on duty with a heart attack. His wife and children, they have, it's the summer months, they have gone, apparently because the son had some engineering exam or something, so she has taken the son for that. He's staying alone at that point in time. The moment he mind you, he knows me from my toddler age. Moment he saw, he called me by my pet name, Arey, you are on duty. I said, don't worry. I just pacified him and I took ECG and I gave him a very positive this one. Said, don't worry, everything will be fine. He made a remark actually. What is there left to be fine? See, there itself that feeling of...
You had a negative...
Negative, he sort of given up, no? Even before we started the treatment. And then anyway we started what was appropriate, we started the treatment. The next day, by which time the family was informed, the wife came and all. Even when the wife came, she was allowed inside the intensive care. She said, just came. This man looked. Said, oh, okay, you have come. Okay, wait. That kind of a bland, emotionless kind of a thing. The third day, unfortunately or fortunately, again I am on duty from 2 p.m. to 10 p.m. Around 5:15, the nurse says, sir, please come. Because I was attending another patient. This man went in for a cardiac arrest, what we call in our parlance as ventricular fibrillation. That's usually a preterminal event. I immediately rushed because we give the direct current shock for reverting the rhythm. This gentleman by that time hadn't lost his consciousness, mind you. One sentence which he told me still is there. He called me by my pet name as I am known. He said, in Tamil he told, please leave me alone. Just one sentence, he said. He addressed me by my name and he said, please leave me alone. My medical training and my youthfulness and enthusiasm didn't allow me that, and I went ahead, I did a temporary pacing, everything I did, I couldn't revive him. We lost him.
He had already made up his mind.
Yes, exited. And this is just one example I gave you. When you say about the body-mind, one example. That is why I say, this Professor Krukoff's what is called off-site prayers and all those things. Something similar in a different way is already happening in Bhagwan's hospital here in Whitefield. When every day when we have the bhajan, that kind of vibration it produces amongst the patients. And there is no force on the patients or relatives to join. They come voluntarily. And they get so much...
This bhajan, I think you should explain it for the benefit of listeners. They may not
just
know
just a congregational singing.
I know that, but you don't do it in the wards, do you?
We do it in the wards.
You do it in the wards?
Yes, very much.
Who does it? Sevadals?
All the patients gather together. And a couple of nurses, if they are free, they join together. One or two sevadals who are posted, they join together. And it is a regular affair. And I am now in my 12th year. And in fact, every evening I actually enter the ward when the bhajan is going on. So much so, I got addicted to it. And I am telling you, people may laugh at me all over the world when I state this being a medical man, but I can tell you that has such a profound influence on the recovery of the patient. This is irrespective of whatever religion the patient professes.
Incidentally, now that you mentioned bhajan, the sobering and stabilizing influence of bhajan, I must mention, you might be knowing it, but many listeners might not, that when famous Mrs. Kiran Bedi was appointed the superintendent of Tihar Jail, she introduced bhajans.
Yes.
And that produced a lot of calmness and tranquility in a jail that was otherwise notorious for all kinds of, you know, bad behavior by the prisoners.
See, again we started off body-mind. Yes. All of these influences, if you say, finally are being directed to the mind. If you kindly permit me, just a few minutes you will give me on a practice of the Sandhya Vandana.
Yes.
Which was handed over from generation to generation.
Yes, yes.
Which today, unfortunately, has become just a cursory ritual.
For many, it's not. They don't even know that there is such a ritual.
Ritual.
I know it because my mother used to say, if you don't do it, no food.
Yeah.
That's how I was.
No, but see that, you see how beautifully it was devised. At
three times a day.
Dawn, when the sun is at zenith, and at dusk, number one. Two, primarily if you see, it was an offering of your obeisance to the sun god. Three, if you see, today we know, sun is life, no sun, no life. Today science we have proved that yes, if the sun decides to be off, finish, that's all, the whole world will be wiped out. They understood that, and they gave very esoteric meaning to that, that final, the final existence of life on this earth is sun. That's what your Sandhya Vandana enjoined. Big, you must have heard, of course, many listeners, at least in the Western world, know of the theory of auto-suggestion, which was propounded by Emil de Coo. And many psychologists and all, they actively promoted that. Sandhya Vandana was nothing but auto-suggestion. Every day, if you see some part of the mantra, wherein you are praying to the sun god to illumine your intelligence, you are praying to him that from my last night going to bed and getting up today morning, advertently, inadvertently, whatever mistake I committed by my speech, my hands, my feet, almost all my organs, everything, kindly forgive me and illumine me that I should not repeat it. What is it? It's pure auto-suggestion. It's something like, as you just now mentioned about two patients, two similar, one man saying that I am dying, he died. Another man who said, no, I will live, he lived. This is what it was. Unfortunately, today nobody tells you the meaning of the Sandhya Vandana mantras. And you see, the ultimate, if you reach to that last sloka of the Sandhya Vandana, ultimate in the non-dualism or Advaita. And with a very, very small, simple example, Akashat Patitam Toyam. Sagaram Pratigachati. Water which is falling, any part of the earth, final destination is the ocean. This is a fact now everybody knows. Sarvadeva Namaskaram Sri Keshavam Pratigachati. Irrespective of whatever religion, form, god, godhead, stone, tree, fruit, whatever you worship, it reaches to only one supreme being. What more you want? Unfortunately, such a rich treasure, today, it has, people are ignorant of it.
Okay, what you are saying in short is that Sandhya Vandanam is a good mental discipline, also on account of pranayama, because
yes,
we have is a good breathing exercise, and body-mind control in the form of prayer, encoded in the form of prayer.
See, the three times that pranayama, it was prescribed there way back, chanting the Gayatri Mantra in the ratio of 1:4:2. They didn't have clocks to time, 1:4:2. They had to time it with the chanting. You must have seen in our Vatavriksha or that famous tree which Bhagwan planted on Guru Purnima way back, I think, 19...
Yeah, it's near that museum.
Museum. There, if you see one, there is a placard there. Meditation is watching the breath. I read it one day and I have been pondering on it since then. Basically, to do that pranayama in the ratio of 1:4:2
is 1 is inhalation,
4 is
retention,
2 is exhalation. Now, when you are doing that, finally, if you see, you are gaining a control on the autonomic nervous system. And if you succeed in gaining control on the autonomic nervous system, your 99% of the disease ceases to exist.
So I am tempted to ask you, how much do I owe you, doctor, for that? No. Now, I want to slightly change the subject and ask you a question about what is sometimes referred to as a psychosomatic disease. What is that?
Psyche.
That's the reason why I ask this.
Psyche, as modern science understands, is very roughly the mind. Somatic, affecting the body systems, the body structures. again, we have again come back to the same body-mind relationship. In fact, if you see, at least maybe I don't know how many years from now, 50 or 100 or 200 years, I don't know, a stage will come when uniformly almost any kind of diseases, whether it is infectious or malignant or other acquired diseases, you will finally find that there is a relationship between the mind and body. Now, current understanding of psychosomatic diseases are just a handful of diseases wherein they say that, okay, you may sustain personalities who are jittery, nervous, and who are always on their toes, and even small upsets can really throw them off balance. Such people, they say, oh, they get hypertension, they get hyperacidity, they get gastric ulcer, they can get heart attack. And then they say, oh, this is basically psychosomatic problem, so you give him tranquilizer drugs so that he'll calm down.
The reason I asked you is, I have heard once asthma being described as partially psychosomatic.
One way of presentation of asthma in many patients, see, asthma, the many etiologies or causative factors, psychosomatic element is there. Why? And in support of very interesting, maybe in the 70s, there was a magazine called Mirror which used to come in India.
Yes, yes.
And just, I was in school at that time and I read very beautiful thing. In a hotel room, a man who had come on tour, he was sleeping and he was a known asthmatic. And the only thing was, he used to get his attacks if the rooms were closed. Some kind of a claustrophobia, you may say. That day it so happened, he had some meetings and all, he was so tired, he came and slept off. And middle of the night, he got up with the breathing difficulty and wheezing and all. And he just couldn't, because it was, the room was new and there were no lights, so he just was groping to find at least a window and open it. Finally, he came across something which he felt was glass. He just hammered it with the chair. It glass broke. Our man went back and he slept on the cot and got up peacefully in the morning. Because he believed that he had broken the window pane and fresh air will come, so his attack will go. His attack went and he slept. Next morning, when he gets up and the light comes in, he sees he has broken that grandfather clock which was there.
The reason I asked this question is interesting. Long ago, I remember seeing in Madras on the TV a program. Forget his name. His name was Marthandam or somebody, psychiatrist. And he was discussing the case of a boy, 14-year-old boy. This boy suddenly, 2 years prior to that, began to get asthmatic attacks. And they took him, that is to say the boy, to a dargah.
Yeah.
And there was a saibu there. And for 40 days he treated him, with all his neem leaves and all that. And this boy was cured. So the questioner asked, what is there in that? And he still remember it, I can't forget it. He said that man didn't do any mantra or anything. Then how did he get cured? He cured him with love. That man doesn't know anything, but he's a very loving person. And then he narrated the history of this boy. This boy was suddenly threatened by the father. If you don't get him good marks, I will thrash you and things like that. That produced a panic. And that triggered off this body reaction, mind-body connection. And they took him to all these doctors, that doctor, because he would get this asthmatic fits, which were very painful and so on. But no, they used to give all the standard allopathic medicines, which didn't produce any effect. Because it would come unknown, suddenly. That element of fear used to trigger it. This man talked to him nicely, and that boy lost his fear. He says, that is the real cure. It came on account of the mind, and it went away on account of the mind.
In this case, if you permit me, it's like, you have that safety valve of the pressure cooker.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond the limit, when the pressure rises, it goes up and it releases the extra pressure.
Exactly.
The manifestation of asthma was actually an expression of repressed fears.
So it is a classic case of the body responding to the turbulence of the mind.
It can be in the form of asthma. I have seen people who have got perineal rhinitis. I have seen people who get headaches, which they have undergone every possible test under the sun. Nothing worked out. People who have got what they call modern sense, like irritable bowel syndrome. It is nothing but people who have got a disorderly bowel habit and who keep frequently visiting the toilet, and they must have tried every medicine. All of them, if you see, and there is a whole huge bunch of actual list of diseases which now modern science is realizing that an element, see, the problem, again I am telling, as you had mentioned a little while earlier, we tend to develop a tunnel vision when we are pursuing the modern science. The psyche aspect in a somatic manifestation of disease is definitely one aspect of it. It cannot be exclusive. In fact, if somebody, who suppose you say, cigarette smoking causes cancer. Okay, fine. The next question I'll ask is, do everybody who smokes cigarette, do they get cancer? You say, no, answer is no. Why is it that only an X number of people who smoke cigarettes, they get cancer? Then, okay, you give the next, the pack years, number of cigarettes he has smoked, the duration he has smoked, the depth he has smoked, and all that, so many things. Finally, now you reach, there is a genetic susceptibility for them. You came to this stage. Again, I say, that is also one arm of it. If you see in any, whether it be a mental disorder or a physical disorder, you leave that apart. There is an intimate connection between the mind and the body. And the environmental factors are facilitators only. See, a small example. Rain is coming. 10 children get wet in the rain. 6 of them are down with some fever and cold and cough. Another 4, even I have done, even you must have done in your childhood, in that rain playing football in the slush. Nothing happened. The frame of mind. Again, frame of mind, when you say, it has got a profound influence on the immune system. Now again I am going back. If you say the yoga, the pranayama, the various sandhya vandana or the other mantras or bhajans, all if they are all indirectly influencing the mind to tone up our immune system.
Okay, now that you mentioned the mind, let me ask you this question. Some people have depression. Obviously it's connected with the mind. So my question is this. What are the body ailments that people with depression are normally subjected to?
See, depression...
This is very common. No? Especially in tense societies,
it is
people
common.
Get depressed.
It is like it's a frustration arising out of unfulfilled desires.
Problems are there, family problems are there.
So many factors.
So how does depression affect the body and what are the usual ailments, body?
See, again, now there are actually enough number of papers published about a lowered immune response in patients who are depressed.
Okay, so basically it lowers the immune response.
One arm of it.
Okay.
Two, once naturally you have, it is like what we call the current HIV infected patient. He has a lowered immunity. So his susceptibility to otherwise innocuous infection.
All sorts of attacks.
Attacks are there. This is one aspect. Two, the body's defense mechanism exists in all organ systems. All organ systems. So, that's why I say...
That's very interesting.
It extends all organ systems. That is, when people today, today's modern medicine, when somebody says, oh, I am the brain specialist, or I am just the neuron specialist, or I am just the eye specialist, specializing only in retina. You can't dissect the human body like that. Each patient, if you call, is an individual. And each has to be studied. It needs time. You can't do it like an assembly line process of manufacturing cars or telephones. You can't see patients. Oh, all patients with coronary artery disease, the blanket treatment. That's what current world is doing. To some extent, we are also doing. But what I say, the rightful approach will be, if we say 10 patients who have disease affecting the heart, coronary artery disease, the artery supplying the heart, if they have it, for the 10 of them, you can have 10 different approaches. There may be 3 who are definite candidates for getting improvement in surgery. Another couple of them who will say, okay, surgery, so you can do a angioplasty, what is there, we put a balloon-like thing and put a scaffolding of steel or some other metal. There will be another 5 whom, if you sit through, properly understand them, they can be perfectly managed well with medicines. And a stage comes when even that may not be required.
So, getting back to depression, lowering of the resistance is one. What else?
All the so-called...
Because you said that is not the only thing.
All the so-called modern-day illnesses, what you call modern-day when I say, incidence of diabetes has been known to be more, incidence of hypertension has been known to be more, heart attacks leading to sudden death have been known to be more. incidence of, and there are two varieties. One group of depressed is going for massive obesity.
Hmm.
Other group becoming severely emaciated.
Does it both ways?
So, again, now getting back to the root of what you are calling depression. Almost more than 80% of the ones, or 80 to even almost 90% of ones whom we are categorizing as depression, are basically are not true depressive by the way of how it's defined scientifically. There are a group of or a subset of patients who have certain brain biochemical problems. They are the ones who have the real depression, if you ask. And they are the ones who need management by way of modern medical therapy and all.
What do you mean by brain biochemical problems?
So nowadays, it is coming up that levels of various enzymes and hormones in the brain. Now that is the new thing coming.
Okay, it is due to purely body chemistry.
Chemistry in the, at the brain level, where this is the current they have discovered, whether it is schizophrenia or whether it is depression. They are now realizing that, okay, there
that
is...
That could even be genetic in origin.
The ones, the what I call the real serious variety of depression.
Hmm.
The other variety, what you are telling, if you
due
ask...
Due to environment.
It is mainly environmental. It's mainly environmental.
I'm talking mainly about that.
Environmental. And...
Not a built-in biochemical.
The environmental one,
hmm.
The answer is Bhagwan. What he is stating as what should be your ideal lifestyle. Whether it's a ceiling on desires, what he talks, whichever way you interpret it. Whether what he propounds as love, not as an emotion, but love as an energy. That is the answer for that depression.
Since you brought up the spiritual angle, after our fairly long conversation, let me end on the same note. This afternoon I was listening to a radio program broadcast from America. It was very interesting. It was about a 50-plus-year-old lady who at the age of 17 became paralyzed. She was diving. The water was shallow. She had a sort of a injury which affected her nervous system. And rendered her a quadriplegic or something like
that. Yeah, all the four limbs you can't move.
Okay, the quadriplegic, that's right. And she has become something like a celebrity after a couple of years of, vegetable-like existence almost and depression. And she was talking about how the transformation came to her. She said, I suddenly discovered God and I found that I had nothing. But I could borrow from God as much as I want, and He was within me. She was all the time talking about faith in God, and she was just going to raptures. She said, look, there are at least six people who help me every day with my body functions, and I feel, too exhausted and all that. But then I tell myself, God, I can't be like this. They have done so much for me. Give me a bit of your smile. I want to smile at them. And she says that gives energy. And then it went on like that. She is absolutely sold on God. She does radio broadcasts and all that. She has formed a big society to help, disabled people and so on. She has been a member of a committee that has passed a new act in Congress giving help to disabled. But one question the interviewer asked, you blame God for what happened to you? You think you have been cursed? She said, no. I think God has given me my life. By giving me this disability. In what way? Look, my life has become purposeful. I am now able to help so many people. If I hadn't gone through this, my life would have been useless, a waste. I don't think this is a suffering. I thank God for this. I mean, I was just astonished. All her Vedantic wisdom and Vedic wisdom and Puranas and all that was encoded into this woman who is not from our culture. But her heart is in the right place.
Correct, exactly. The question is of realization. It's the same like that.
Who will say that losing my limbs and completely is a blessing from God? And that's what Swami says in Gita when he says, welcome misery. Misery is a friend because it will help you to discover God. And that's precisely what has happened to them.
And for this lady, it was her own self-realization.
Exactly.
Her self-realization.
And she realized that God is in her because she's all the time drawing strength from within. It's not from somebody else. says, God, I have to do this. Now, come on, give me strength. You know, suddenly the Gita became alive for me when I heard this.
See, Gita, if you see, the emphasis is always on interiorization rather than exteriorization. Today's pursuit is all exteriorization.
You must look inwards.
Inward. When the exteriorization occurs, then you see all this. Whatever you are seeing, if you see in a very broad perspective, whatever so-called ills of today's modern world society we see, is exteriorization. If irrespective of your caste, creed, color, religion, nationality, geographical boundaries, if you just knew this technique of interiorization, you, each one of us, I would say, irrespective of who we are or what we are, we would realize we can't just count so much of blessings which
absolutely,
you have.
Absolutely, there is no question. I mean, we don't realize our blessings. We only count what we have not got.
It's a comparison. On a comparative scale, we look at somebody.
Why Swami says, if you have lost one hand, say so many people have lost two hands. If you have lost both hands, say so many people have lost two hands and two legs. Incidentally, this lady has learned to paint using her teeth, holding a brush. And she has exhibited her works in so many big exhibitions in New York and Washington and so on and so forth. And the courage.
Yes, that. Why? Recent years, Stephen Hawking?
Yes, that's an remarkable.
Excellent.
And before that, Helen Keller.
Keller? Mm. Excellent. Why God? So, that courage, whatever you call that, that inner thing, because they could interiorize. Basic thing is what they could interiorize. Which most of us are unable to do.
Well, thank you, doctor. You have taken so much of your time. I am glad that today there were no patients to keep you busy there. I hope we have more opportunities, because this is just the beginning of what I hope would be a long and extended series. I have many, many, many things to discuss with you. Just for your information, on my way to the studio, I ran into one of our younger colleagues who is connected with Radio Sai activities. He was very excited about this interview with you, or discussion which I was going to have. And he said, sir, I've already given this series a name. I said, what is this? And he says, this series we should call it Arogya Vahini. So you have no choice, you have to come again and again and tell us about many things. I want to discuss so many things as an offshoot of today's discussion. And I look forward to the pleasure of having you with us soon. Thank you, meanwhile. And on behalf of myself, Radio Sai, and all our numerous listeners all over the world, Jai Sai Ram.
Thank you very much. Jai Sai Ram.
Soham, soham, dhyan karo. Sai, dhyan karo.
Sadguru Sai, dhyan karo.
Sadguru Sai, dhyan karo.
Sadguru Sai, dhyan karo.
Soham, soham, dhyan karo.
ध्यान करो
सोहम
साई
हृदय भरो ब्रह्मानंद से हृदय भरो करो सतगुरु साई ध्यान करो
सतगुरु साई ध्यान करो
सोहम ध्यान करो सोहम ब्रह्मा सोहम विष्णु
सोहम ब्रह्मा सोहम विष्णु
सोहम साई ध्यान करो
सोहम साई ध्यान करो
सोहम आत्मा शिव परमात्मा
ध्यान करो